This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Journalist Pete Early reports in his new book, Crazy, that the largest public mental health facility in America is not a hospital. It is the Los Angeles County Jail. On any given day, it houses 3,000 mentally disturbed inmates. Early began investigating how we treat or do not treat mental illness when his mentally ill son, Mike, committed a crime, was arrested, and was thrust into the justice system. When Mike Early began showing signs of mental illness, he was a college student. Mike said he was okay, just stress. Then a friend called Mike's dad. Something, the friend said, was very wrong. Mike hadn't slept in 5 days. Mike was hospitalized. Not long after being released, there was another psychotic episode. Pete Early thought his son needed another stay in the hospital. But the intake doctor would not admit Mike. Why? Mike was an adult, and he was refusing treatment. Pete Early, as you can imagine, was beside himself. His son clearly was very ill. Pete Early is a former reporter for The Washington Post. He is the author of 8 books of nonfiction and 2 books of fiction. His latest book, a book of nonfiction, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. The book is published by Putnam. Pete Early, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Your son gave you his blessing to write this book. When you asked him about it, what did he say?
He felt that if it could help other people, then he'd want to go ahead and have his story told. I must tell you, since then, he and I both have had lots of feelings, yes, pro and con, about how wise it is to tell his story so openly. But I think both of us feel strongly that you need to put a human face on this to really communicate that, one, mental illnesses can happen to anyone, two, that they are not the person's fault who gets them, and three, you can end up in jail and prison because of a mental illness.
Hmm. Has he read the book?
He has read all the parts about him. He refused to read it while I was working on it because he didn't want to interfere. And his attitude, quite frankly, now is, that's behind me. I don't want to dwell on it. I'm trying to get my life together. I'm glad you did that, but leave me out of it.
Yeah. How's he doing today?
Well, today, actually, he's doing great. One of the sad things I discovered, Celeste, is that this is not a book that has a guaranteed happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when you write a book, you bring it to closure and you move on. My son was on probation for 2 years. During that time, he took his medication. He was stable. He did absolutely great. About 6 months after he was off probation, for some reason, he quit taking his medication. That's not uncommon for people who have bipolar disorder. He went downhill rather quickly, and my wife was able to talk him into going back on it after he began losing his friends and was called in at the job he had and told he was having behavior problems. Since then, he's back on his medication. His birthday actually is tomorrow. His Christmas gift to me this year was that he promised to stay on his meds until his birthday. So we have been talking of late whether he will continue to stay on the medication.
Hmm. I have my fingers crossed for you tomorrow.
Well, I appreciate that because this is, I think, the hardest thing for a parent. One of the things I tried to learn on this, my trips to Miami, where I went to look at the mental health structure, was how parents deal with this. I interviewed parents, one parent whose son has chronic schizophrenia. For 9 years, she drove by her son, who was homeless, living on the street, eating out of garbage cans, and how you do that as a parent. How you see that kind of illness and not being able to intervene, not being able to save your child, is an incredible burden. The people who have the mental illness, of course, are the victims of the illness, but those who love them also suffer.
Yeah. As I was reading Mike's story early in the book, at the point where the intake doctor wouldn't admit him, the question just leaped to mind. Is a person who's having a psychotic episode capable of informed consent?
And that's the key to this whole argument. you know, I love my son. I don't want his civil rights denied. But if a person is not thinking clearly, are you not obligated to step in and try to help them? And, of course, that is the hot issue. When you're a parent, it becomes very transparent. When you have a son who's sitting in a living room with tinfoil wrapped around his head, watching a TV set, convinced that the CIA is beaming messages to him, there's not much question in your mind what you want to do. You want to get that person help. And you don't want to wait until the person becomes in imminent danger, which is what the law requires. You don't want them to either have to hurt someone or hurt themselves.
Yeah. Now, adult children can face similar situations with parents. Spouses can face similar situations with one another. What are the options if your loved one is ill, an adult, and refuses treatment?
Well, there aren't a whole lot of options. A number of things have been tried. Interestingly enough, in Florida, the law to have someone committed is called the Baker Act. That is so difficult to do that a lot of parents and loved ones use another law, which is called the Marchman Act. That allows people to put for 60 days anyone who has a drug or alcohol problem. So a lot of times the parent will say, oh, my son has a drug or alcohol problem, and try to get them picked up and locked up for 60 days, which is much longer than most mental health services, and just to get them off the streets and get them treatment. The real problem, there's two problems here, though. It's not only how do you get someone who doesn't want to be treated treatment, but how do you find treatment?
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered in Miami is there really isn't any treatment out there. It's extremely hard to get someone services. The money that should be spent on services is going to build jails and prisons, and being spent in federal fund form for medication, the high cost of medication.
Yeah. The need is so huge, yet we're largely unaware of the scope of this. And I know we use this word a lot, crisis, but this is truly a crisis, isn't it?
I was really shocked at that almost every family in America has someone who's a relative who has a severe mental illness. There are 51 million Americans who have severe mental illnesses. And yet no one talks about it because of the stigma and the shame, which one of the reasons I wrote this book is that mental illnesses, to the best of our scientific knowledge, are chemical imbalances that affect how nerve cells in your brain send and receive messages. They can strike anyone. It's your brain is an organ like the heart. We wouldn't condemn someone who had a heart attack, and yet we are terrified of people who have a mental illness. And I think a lot of that has to do with our own fear. What would this happen? It happens to us. What would we do? And also, I think we want to blame people who have a mental illness. It makes us feel better when we walk by the man ranting on the corner and think, oh, he wants to be that way, or he's choosing to be that way. And in fact, in the 70s and 80s and the 60s, there was a lot of argument, oh, schizophrenia is just a different way of thinking. We now know better than that.
Yeah, I want to get back to that you know, the how we got to this point, you know, how we've come to where we are today. And I want to get to that issue here in just a moment, but I do have someone, I have a couple of callers now waiting to talk with you, Pete, so let's go and take these calls. First listener who wants to talk with you this afternoon is calling in from Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
My older brother was terribly bipolar. And I'm glad that you're speaking to this issue of, I think, ultimately, although I don't think you've really been clear about this, but the problem with the way society treats the psychologically ill the fact that we don't have any kind of real safety net for these people, it's really tragic that we don't have national health care, but especially in the context of the mentally ill. I wanted to note, though, that my brother, we tried to get him help for a long time, and it was extremely difficult. because we couldn't really get him to try to get help either. So we were hoping to get him onto Social Security or something. He was in his late 40s. But eventually, because we were concerned about our own safety and so on, and his, of course, obviously as well, there was really very little we could do. And so we tried to get him on medicine, and he was trying to get a job and so forth. And basically, to make a long story short, he started the medicine, and we didn't realize, apparently, according to a good friend of mine who's a psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, it's very common for people who suddenly go on to medicine to commit suicide. And so at the end of the day, he either committed suicide or accidentally drowned. We're not really sure what happened, but I hope that people who are listening will be very careful how they deal with situations like that. But what I see, though, is more than anything else, the tragedy of our country not dealing with this. And in fact, it seems to me it's gotten worse, that we're not really, well, with this administration, for example, we're not really dealing with the ill, including the mentally ill. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I know that wasn't easy for your caller to say.
Yeah.
I think you'd be shocked how many emails, letters I have received. My book only came out yesterday, but I've already received literally hundreds of emails from families who have gone through this same kind of situation. You know, people think, because these are chemical imbalances, they think, oh, if we can just get the right medicine. And while medicine is effective in 80% of the cases, you really require more than medicine, and that's part of the problem. You know, there are a lot of folks with mental illness. 16% of all the people in jails and prison today have a serious mental illness. So we get them out. But if we get them out and there's no treatment, there's no housing, there's no help for them, then they end up just recycling back. And if you go into a program and all you get is a pill stuffed in your mouth, that's not the answer either. You really need a comprehensive program in place. And we just don't have it. We do not have it, and we have. There seems to be very little interest, especially in the federal government, in setting such a program up.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hello. One, I have bipolar illness, but I do very well because, one, I am married and I have children, and I've never gotten delusionally psychotic. But I have a sister who was depressed for years, and then when she hit 45, she became totally delusional and very, very manic. But she's also a serious alcoholic. So she left her husband, moved in with my parents. My mother was 78 and my father 80. Us children did not trust my sister because of her drinking problem. It took over 6 months to finally get her committed to a hospital. And then from the psychiatric hospital, private, she went to a state hospital. At the state hospital, she was on medication that she just shook so terribly. As soon as she was released, she went off her medicine. While she was in the hospital, my mother, because of the stress of taking care of my sister, had a massive heart attack. She died. And as kids, we like sort of blame ourselves because we weren't taking care of our sister. But at the same time, we call the mental help. We call the police. And it's like until she's a danger to herself or others, you cannot have her hospitalized. And you're right, there is no safety net. So when she was released from the state hospital, she's living with my father only because he's too embarrassed to have her as a homeless person in the city. You know, so we visit, and it's like, it's stressful, but we can't do anything about it.
And that is part of the reason I wrote this book. Thank you for sharing that. I was absolutely horrified when I was turned away from the emergency room with my son, who was clearly delusional, clearly psychotic, had a history of having mental problems. And I was basically told until he hurt someone or himself,
right, That's what we're waiting for.
And I believe that's wrong. I believe that we have gone too far on the legal spectrum, that we need to bring doctors back in the process. We need to bring family members back in it. We need to set up a more humane situation. You know, it used to be that if you were committed, it really was a life sentence. You were sent to a terrible state hospital.
Yeah.
You never got out. You never had treatment. And these places were compared to Nazi concentration camps, and no one wants that to happen again.
Right.
By the
right.
same token, nowadays, if you are committed, it usually means a very short stay in a hospital that usually is the
two weeks.
Just a wing of a hospital that's right down the street.
Right,
And till you're stabilized, and then you are released. Trust me, insurance companies do not want you staying longer than you have to.
I know. And my sister was able, she refused to take any medication in the private psychiatric hospital, so she was sent to the state hospital where, yes, they forced medicine on her, but at the same time, they weren't looking at the side effects. And my sister is an artist. So I can understand totally the feelings of a person on these heavy psychotropics when you're shaking so badly. It's worse than the treatment.
Right.
You know,
I've interviewed people who had Thorazine who were literally snatched off the street, and they've had shots of Thorazine and the horrible things that that happened to them. I'm not unaware of that.
Yeah.
By the same token, I think that the medications have changed. We do not allow lobotomies anymore.
Right.
We do not allow a lot of these horrible things. And you have to be on guard for that. I understand that. But I don't see much humane about letting a person who is psychotic live on the street where they're attacked by teenage thugs with baseball bats and, you know, have to eat out of garbage cans, and just letting those people roam without trying to reach out and help them, especially since mental illnesses are progressively get progressively worse if they are not treated.
I know. And it's just so hard on families who want to help, and they just feel their hands are tied.
I absolutely agree. I think that's what we need to change.
I want to thank the listener for her call. Other listeners are invited to join us this afternoon. Our guest is journalist Pete Early. His latest book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you've got a question or a comment, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So how do we find the right balance, Pete, between being sensitive, being cognizant of civil rights, and yet getting help to the people who need it?
Well, I think we need to take a look at the entire system. I think one of the first things we need to do is we need to stop the migration of folks with mental illnesses into jails and prisons. These are not safe places for them. Today, there are 300,000 folks with severe mental illnesses in jails and prisons, another 500,000 on probation. And rather than trying to figure out how we can stop them from going into jails and prisons, we're basically saying, okay, they're in here. We need to build separate facilities for them. And so we are recreating inside jails and prisons the old asylums. You shouldn't. There's something fundamentally wrong about having to become a criminal in order to get some kind of care. So that's one of the first things we need to do. When it comes to the rights issue, I believe we should have a multi-tiered system. Forced medication, forced commitment should be at the very end of that. We should have services. We should have peer counseling. We should have ways to try to step in. For instance, in my son's case, if that doctor would have said, look, the law says I can't force medicate your son, but here's how you contact the community crisis center. And if there had been someone at the community crisis center who could say, hey, look, you know, I have bipolar disorder, I have schizophrenia. Do you remember when you were really doing well? You know, if it's possible to try to talk the person into taking those or try to persuade them. My son sat in a room for 4 hours waiting for a doctor. That suggests to me that he could have been convinced or talked to or somehow encouraged to voluntarily sign up. Instead, he was just kicked out. Now, when that doesn't work, then I believe in forced medication, and I believe in forced treatment. But I believe you have to have safeguards in there to make sure that someone isn't tucked away forever or that horrible things are done to them.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I think it's great that you've written about this and you're talking about it because it just doesn't get talked about. And as someone who's dealt personally, more personally than I would like, for many, many years with mental illness, I have to say that the fact that healthcare programs and insurance companies are so reluctant to address mental health care issues at a point at which they could head off the really serious problematic times is horrible, and that if they would invest more in outpatient care such as psychotherapy and in sort of initial inpatient care of someone who is hospitalized for a week to 2 weeks to get stabilized, if they would allow that person to spend that time, then they could it would be so much more cost efficient in the long run, if you want to break it down just to money, which they seem to want to do. And that a vast majority of homeless people do indeed have a mental health care issue, and they've slipped through the cracks precisely because there are these holes in the safety net, or the safety net's so pathetic. So I'm really glad that you are doing something to make this more public.
Well, I appreciate that, and I also think you bring up some excellent points. You know, sadly, in our culture, there are people who can profit off of illness rather than prevention. And insurance companies obviously want to get away, distance themselves from mental illness issues because they're so expensive.
Yep.
On the other side of the spectrum, you have jails and prisons, which can find, build new programs, hire more people, because you're going to end up locking up more people with mental illness. And you have drug companies, which, God bless them, are our salvation, but they're also charging 100 to 1,000 times percent more than it costs to make some of this medication.
And that's, you know, that I agree, and that's an issue of, you know, ethics across the board with drug companies, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you could hit that with HIV in Africa, you know, the drug cocktail. It does happen with mental health, with psychotropic drugs as well, but that's a horrible thing.
But you know, there's plenty of blame to pass around, and one of them is that the people I've met in Miami and the people that I followed in the jail are people who have no political clout, and they have no voice, and they have no one who's really wants to go in there and fight for them because it's to no one's advantage. And, you know, we have a lot of prejudices against, and it's very controversial when it comes to mental illnesses.
Yeah.
People feel sorry for me and my son because my son broke into a house to take a bubble bath. If it was anybody else, you know, I could laugh at that and say, well, obviously the guy's psychotic. It's not hard to feel sorry for my son for doing that. It's very hard to feel sorry for someone who chops off their daughter's arms during a breakdown.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are all controversial issues.
They are, and your point that it's there's so much stigma about talking about it it's so important, and that's why I am grateful that you're addressing this, and that you know, I think it's necessary for people to know, as you said, anybody can get a mental illness, and in fact, most people probably know somebody who is treated for one. And they just don't realize that they know that person. It's so much more frequent than people understand. And wish you all the best. And
thank you.
Thanks a lot for your
work. I hope you find the book interesting.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Muhammad on line four. Hi.
Hi. I'd just like to comment on the bravery it takes to speak out about mental illness. My paternal uncle is schizophrenic, and my father, before he passed away, was bipolar. And I have to say that I feel rather lucky that I've just come out of it being unipolar, meaning that I only get depressed and have responded to the first medication they ever put me on, which I feel very fortunate. But I did go through a couple of tough episodes, and the stigma that I felt in the workplace, and I was a very long-time employee with a very good work record and ethic, but I found that I was almost ostracized and penalized. As a result, after 16 years with a large company, I ended up leaving. And I was just wondering if the author could speak to what his experience was with his son and possibly some other people he interviewed with that. And then I'll sign off after so that I won't stay on the line.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Good questions.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because after my son was on probation and we were able to get him treatment and he stabilized, he wanted to go back to work. And he particularly wanted to go back to work before his court case came up, because he was charged with two felonies, even though he'd broken into a house to take a bubble bath. And he knew that once he got a criminal record, it'd be harder for him to get a job. Now, my son had finished college. He had a college degree, and yet he couldn't get a job working at a local supermarket bagging groceries, because he had been told that there's nothing embarrassing about having a mental illness. It's a chemical problem. So when he was asked, he'd say, yes, I have bipolar disorder, but I'm on medication. I got so frustrated, I went to talk to one of the human relations directors at a company that had rejected his application. And the guy said, look, I'd like to help your son, but if I knowingly hire someone with a mental illness and that person has a psychotic breakdown, other employees can sue the company because they can say they put a person in a dangerous situation. So even if I want to help your son, I can't hire him. Tell him not to tell anyone that he has a mental illness. And that is what we ended up doing. And my son eventually got a minimum wage job, which he's doing now. But it's very hard to fight that stigma. And if when my son went off his medication recently, if his boss would have known he had a mental illness, I'm sure he would have been fired.
Hmm. What was your son? You said your son was charged with two felonies. He broke into a home, and he took a bubble bath.
Well, he was he had an overwhelming sense. After I brought him from the hospital, the next 48 hours, I watched him decompose. I tried to grind up his medicine and put it in his breakfast cereal. Mm-hmm. He got angry at me and demanded to be taken to his mother's house, my ex-wife. On the route there, drive there, he got angry and literally leaped out of a moving car. 48 hours later, he got up and left the house without her knowing it. He picked up a patio chair, threw it through a door, went inside. The people luckily were gone. He turned over several pictures they had on the mantle. He drank some booze out of their refrigerator. He broke an antique dish of theirs. He went up and took a bubble bath, and he left the water running, which did damage in the house. He was charged with two felonies, which it's not uncommon for prosecutors to charge someone with the maximum and then plea down to a lesser offense. In our case, he happened to pick a house where the homeowners had no compassion, no sympathy, or no understanding about mental illness, and they literally wanted him imprisoned and sent away. And I had a very hard time dealing with that, and we went through quite a long ordeal in court. As I was writing this book, I began to understand that maybe this is the kind of person I wanted to reach. And I stopped for a minute and I thought, what would I have felt if I'd come downstairs and seen a man who I didn't know, who had just broken into the back of my house and was, you know, clearly delusional. And I began to realize that I may have had that same kind of attitude that these people had. And it was a journey for me to try to not only come to a point where I could no longer hate these people, but understand that this is what I needed to do, was try to get them to understand what I had learned during my journey to Miami.
Hmm. Did the system, in your son's case, take into account criminal intent?
Well, here's what it boiled down to, and I'm really glad you asked that. What it boiled down to is that most cases are plea bargained. We hired an attorney, and he said, "Oh, this is no problem. We'll simply plea bargain this out, and we'll get two misdemeanors, and we'll be fine. You'll get a year of probation, and you can go on with your life." The prosecutor's office agreed to that. So then when we went to court, the victims came, and the victims said, "Wait a minute, nobody talked to us." As you should know, no prosecutor wants to be anti-victim, and the victims have tremendous amount of clout, and they said, "We want him pleading guilty to a felony." The prosecutor explained, "Hey, he'll do a year of probation either way. If you give him a felony, he will be scarred for life as a felon. He'll lose certain rights. And most importantly, my son had wanted to become a teacher, and you can't become a teacher if you have a felony in the state where we lived." They said they didn't care. They wanted him to plead to a felony. So in a matter of 5 minutes, we had to decide whether he'd plead not guilty, which the chances of him being found not guilty were slim since he was arrested inside the house. We could plead guilty and accept a felony, or we could plead not guilty by reason of insanity, at which point he would have had a permanent record that showed that he had been found insane, and he would have been taken immediately from the courtroom to a forensic hospital and been held there. Luckily, the police officer involved convinced them to give us more time. And then, as you'll read in the book, we go through this long process, and eventually we're able to get him to plead guilty to two misdemeanors.
Let's talk about Miami-Dade County. That's where your research for the book took you. I mentioned the situation at the Los Angeles County Jail in my introduction. How many of the inmates at Miami-Dade are likely to be mentally ill?
Well, there's 16% is usually the average that's given nationally. A lot of folks think it may be more like 20%. I initially went to the Los Angeles County Jail, and I was there for 2 weeks, and they asked me to leave because they were afraid that federal HIPAA, which are the Privacy Act, might be violated if I was there. I went to Miami because it is the has the highest population of mentally ill of any major city, 9%. And I went to the jail there, and I spent all of my time on the 8th and 9th floor where the most psychotic prisoners are held. And it really was a step back to really barbaric times, through no fault of the jail. It was an ancient, antiquated, really horrific building, and they put these people in naked in the suicide cells, the first ones that you saw, naked with nothing in there except a glass cell front where you can be watched. And when I went in there and I saw these people suffering in the cold because of a design flaw, it was about 64 degrees in the cells. Imagine being in there naked 24 hours a day with lights on with nothing, but that's it. You're just in there naked. Of course, I thought about my son.
Tell us about the people who work there, the people who are trying to, you know, trying to do a job. I'm thinking here of Dr. Poitier. How does somebody like that, what did you learn from him?
Well, I learned a lot. He's a very compassionate fellow. I think sometimes we have in our mind that the only people who work in these kind of institutions are folks who can't get jobs anywhere else. And that was not the case with him. He was a psychiatrist. He felt very strongly, he's African-American, and he felt very strongly that he wanted to give something back to the African-American community. And he felt that in the jail, poor people, African-Americans, folks who don't have any kind of resources are much more likely to end up incarcerated. And so he went into forensic psychiatry. And what he discovered, though, was that basically he performed triage. I went with him on his rounds one day, and we saw, I think it was like 90 patients, and he had about 12 seconds with each patient. These are not situations, they're not settings where anyone can really be treated. All you can do is try to get someone to take medicine so that they can get through the court system. We were The cells were badly outdated. There were sometimes six people in a two-man cell. And he was working under the absolute worst conditions.
Yeah. How many of these inmates who are mentally ill are also likely to be addicted to drugs and or alcohol? And are those problems addressed at all?
Well, that's an excellent question because there's co-occurring problems, and that happens a huge percentage of mentally ill. I think it's 40% have co-occurring disorders. My son never drank or used drugs when he after his first breakdown, when he was first diagnosed with bipolar disorder, he started drinking heavily. And I think it was self-medication. It was trying to slow down his brain. It was trying to help him. Since he's been on his medication, he's again, alcohol-free, and he doesn't use any drugs. It's very difficult sometimes to tell which problem you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And I saw that in Miami. Most of the people who were the ones who ended up in the Miami in the worst conditions, though, were homeless, chronic schizophrenics and dealing with schizophrenia. A lot of these people were the ones who were dumped from state hospitals during deinstitutionalization. And it was really sad because a store owner would get tired of having this person squatting out in front of their store, so the police would arrest them for trespassing. They'd be brought to jail. They'd be incarcerated for 2 or 3 days and turned loose and then arrested a few hours later and brought to jail. There were incidents where this would happen 20 or 30 times a year. So you had this poor person who was just constantly revolving in and out without anyone giving him any help. The other thing I saw in Miami that really troubled me was what are called assisted living, ALFs, assisted living facilities. These were homes, private homes, that were paid to take in mentally ill persons with mental illness. There were 4,000 people with mental illness kept in these homes in Miami. There were 647 of them. 400 of them couldn't pass minimum safety standards. They couldn't even get licensed, but the state allowed people to live in these slums. Oftentimes they had non-English-speaking undocumented workers running them. You'd go in and pills would just be laying all over a table. People would be wandering around, half of them undressed. These were the kind of places that these folks were being put into. So I felt very strongly that we really didn't accomplish what we wanted to with community-based services. We just simply hid the mentally ill better in smaller groups in Miami.
Yeah. This is such a complex problem, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, it's a problem that can be solved. It can be solved with compassion. It can be solved with people saying, okay, we need to do preventative things. And there are some bright spots. One part of my book talks about a program called Passageway. That program takes people who were convicted of serious felonies, usually murder, who were clearly severely mentally ill, and it helps them come back into the community. The first part of it is they're required to stay on their medication and they're closely monitored. But the second part is it gives them a community. It has people who care. They interact. It has good peer counseling. It provides what an asylum really should be, which is a safe place for people to live. And it is amazing to see people who would have been homeless, living on the street, psychotic, tormented by their own demons, living in a wonderful community like that because somebody cares.
Hmm. At the level of the level of government, are there people in legislatures who are challenging the status quo, who are working to make it better?
Well, you know, there are. There's a Senator Domenici from New Mexico has mental illness in his own family. And there's Ted Strickland out of Ohio who has done things. But this is not a popular subject,
yeah.
And it is not something that's going to win a politician any accolades. In Virginia, my home state, we are continually closing down psychiatric beds, and the reason is really simple. It costs the state $500 a day to keep someone in a psychiatric bed. It costs them $89 a day to keep them in a jail cell. If you can save that money and you can improve the roads, if you can cut down the commuter traffic, those are the kind of things that voters are going to reelect you for. They're not going to reelect you for creating a community treatment center in their neighborhood.
Let's take one more call before we run out of time this afternoon. A listener in Indiana, line four, hi.
Hello, I certainly commiserate with you, and everything you just said in the last minute is certainly true here in Indiana. And where I live, there's a state hospital that also has the criminally insane. And, of course, a lot of the people here work there and stuff. Most of the people I've come across in the last 25 years are pretty compassionate. And I think that in the long run, that's what you're talking about, compassion and intelligence, of course, and the ability to step out of your own skin and say, this person's psychotic. They don't really know what they're doing, you know, in terms of common senseism. And I've been involved with a person for 25 years now that's, you know, now they call her bipolar. Used to be manic depressive, of course. And finally, after a lot of things have been done, and I became a main support for this person, the only thing that won out was compassion. And there were certainly events where I'm sure other people might have stepped out of the picture immediately because of... Well, you talked about the fellow didn't want to, I think it was his daughter, you know, out in the streets, homeless. And so he did what he did, but God, what he did was, you know, in some ways, some of the people we have here who are homeless and move around were that first large group that were turned out from the state asylums a few years ago for some federal reason, I guess. I never have gotten it straight, but all of a sudden there were a lot of people deemed not particularly dangerous, were just set out, you know, free, here you go. And, like, God, they didn't have homes or anything, you know. But the city rose to the task and has come up with a large number of different programs that helps out. And the police seem to be pretty understanding with some of these things. And I can speak with some sort of authority because I've been to a lot of the meetings. I know a lot of the people. And I've been through a number of psychiatrists and things like that and meetings, you know, where I've this one particular person, they were going to send her to the state hospital, and I got a lawyer, and that's what it takes sometimes, money and grease and a good lawyer, and you can get some things done occasionally. It's really more beneficial for the person. Now, after that period, the person takes their medicine, has never had any serious problems, you know, outside of society, still has depression and manic moments inside a house. But it's all under control, and they're doing quite well. In fact, they graduated from Purdue University, you know. So those things can be accomplished, but it sure takes some good support and a sensible city. You know, a lot of cities aren't sensible. Thanks a lot. Excellent program.
Thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Pete, you want to just sum up here?
Well, I wanted to comment on that. You know, 80% of persons who are suffering from mental disorders can be helped. You can never be cured, but you can be treated. And that's a huge recovery rate for a chemical problem like this. Because it is a chemical problem, don't make the mistake of thinking that if I just love a person, if I do this beautiful mind type thing where I stick with somebody who has a mental disorder, if I just love them to death, they'll get over it. It doesn't happen that way. I'm sad to say. Sometimes you have to do things that make that person want to hate you, like get them into a hospital or forcibly commit them. It is a chemical problem. It's a problem that has to be treated with medicine, and that's something to remember. Oftentimes, love is just not enough.
There we have to leave it. Pete, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pete Early is a journalist. His latest book is Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. The book is published by Putnam. And that interview was from April of 2006. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The interview we had scheduled for this afternoon with Marcus Erickson, we're going to reschedule that for some time in the future. We had to reschedule that. We will talk with Marcus Erickson at some point in the future. He is the author of My River Home, A Journey from the Gulf War to the Gulf of Mexico.